All right. Hello, 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 everybody. This is Anil Tripathi in this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. So this week, our co-hosts Amy Haynes and Adam Gamwell are off deep in studying for their comprehensive examinations in anthropology coming up just 1 month away. So I'm here with special guest Alina Pokrel, a freshman at an undergraduate at Brandeis University, triple majoring in anthropology, international global studies, and environmental studies. So she definitely has a lot of knowledge in the subject we'll be addressing today, which is environmental anthropology. And for those of you who've been listening to the show, I think by now you probably realize that we really like thinking about how anthropology can open up topics, right, and lead ways to multifaceted discussions about the various forces at play within any field of human activity. And, of course, the environment is a huge area of human activity. So why don't you introduce yourself, Alina, and give a couple words.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alina Pokrel. I'm a junior at Brandeis, and I definitely think that anthropology opens up various doors to look at all of these different aspects of our societies in a new way. So when it comes to environmental thinking, we need to understand that environment is a product of conceptual work. And William Cronin's talks about this very well. How we think about nature is going to have a very tangible impact when it comes to policy making. So we can see that a very common way, a very conventional way that people look at nature is as something being outside of human civilization. There's this human-nature dichotomy that anthropology seeks to abolish, for lack of a better word.
Or just more in-depthly study, right?
Yeah, study in depth. And it's important to then understand why we think that the tree in our garden is not wild or is not as nature as, you know, going on a walk in the forest.
Definitely. And these dichotomies and these ideas that people have about what the environment is, per se, are incredibly pertinent now, right? Especially when you think about global warming and global cooling and different, you know, macro environmental effects, right?
For sure. And also when you look at all the national parks and the nature that we see around us, Central Park, for example, a lot of times, you know, New York City lacks nature, quote-unquote. And Central Park is seen as this pristine nature where you can go take a stroll, but a lot of people don't realize that Central Park used to be a slum, and it is that nature is a product of human activity and human intervention. So I think it's important for all of us to see and embrace the full continuum of natural landscape, which is cultural, which is also the city, which is also the suburb, which is also the wild, and all of these things has its own proper place, and we need to celebrate them without, you know, saying that this is better than the other.
And so where do you think a lot of these dichotomies and certain perceptions come from, right? I mean, they're obviously incredibly powerful, right, in determining how we view the environment and where we view the environment. So what do you think are the groundings of these perceptions within our culture?
So if you look at history, you can it comes from even nature as being apart from civilization. You have writers like Thoreau and Moore who was critical in establishing, you know, even conserving landscapes. So when you look at history, you realize how powerful these ideas were and how they were used in conservation practices, which is incredible. We need spaces. We need to conserve these spaces, but it also has really dangerous ramifications. Also ideas of nature. It's interesting to me how nature has become environment. And if you look at James Scott books on, you know, planning and urban conservation, you see how forestry as a science itself originated by looking at nature as a resource. So you see how James Scott writes about scientific forestry in the 19th century and how strategies such as simplification, homogeneity, legibility, and predictability were used in order to control nature and extract profits from nature. And anything that went against that was seen as a threat, even nomadic people. It was seen as a threat to civilization, which really underscores the governing logic of making land legible and reducing it to a standard grid. So you see, again, the whole dichotomy surfacing between civilization and natural forces.
And, of course, so much conservation efforts have been guided by an effort to actually preserve wildlife, right, as a resource. And we see this definitely in the United States with certain areas, the kind of the passion of, you know, President Theodore Roosevelt in trying to conserve areas for this game, right, game reserves. So this idea that we have to, block off this area, prevent humans from going in and using this area so that we can then use it for this other resource, right? It's almost, you know, these power dynamics then get projected.
For sure. When you talk about conservation, it is about whose knowledge is more powerful, and it is definitely a power play. As you can see, Ramachandra Guha actually writes a really well, a really nice critique of even anthropocentric as well as biocentric methods of conservation. The biocentric method of conservation, obviously, like you said, is essentially taking humans out of the conservation area for the sake of conservation. And as he puts it really well, doing that actually takes the resources out of the hands of the very poor and puts it in the hands of the very rich, because it then becomes either a tourist attraction or it's up for consumption for people who can afford it. And it's incredibly, incredibly dangerous because, as you can see, Project Tiger, which is hailed by, international organizations, and it's used as a successful example of conservation, but you see how in order to preserve this tiger reserve, people were essentially kicked out and people whose livelihoods depended on the forest. You can see that in Kenya with the Maasai people, where they were kicked out of the land in order to preserve this space for consumption. And you can also see it in Tanzania, in many parts of the world, in fact.
And it is dangerous, right? Because when, especially the public impressions of, environmental degradation are so focused on the people who have the least amount of power, right? When you talk about impoverished communities such as in Kathmandu, polluting the river, or people in the slums in India, polluting the city, it takes away time to reflect on the serious environmental polluters, such as, heavy industries and other enterprises, which are, having a much more devastating impact, possibly, especially if we look in the long term, right? There's the idea that black soot emitted by poor communities, that falls out of the atmosphere much quicker than CO2 emissions, which are primarily coming from, large-scale industrialization.
Speaking of pollution and river pollution, especially in Kathmandu, it's interesting that you bring that up because it makes you realize that environmental is not just scientific. It is as much cultural and political as it is scientific. Mm. And all of these problems are a byproduct of political policy, like politics, economic policy, and the social structure. And Annie Rademacher, she was actually at Brandeis sometime last year, and she did an incredible ethnography in Kathmandu on Bagmati River and the whole cleaning up campaign, and on Sukumbasis, basically people who live on the riverbanks. And her insight is incredibly valuable when you look at the entanglements in nature that we see. First of all, there are, these people who've lived there for 40 years or even more. So it's mainly not an issue of pollution or sanitation, but it's an issue of legality, because if you do not have legal housing, you do not have a say in the municipal facilities that you're going to receive. And you don't have a say in what kind of an environment you're going to live in, because these are essentially invisible citizens.
Yeah, and our ways of dealing with the environment are definitely profoundly influenced by society and our culture, right? And these different perceptions at play. Similarly, you know, in the United States, with people thinking more about sustainable energy, electricity, looking at solar panels, it's interesting how, you know, obviously, I think solar power, looking at alternative energy sources is a good thing. It's positive. But there are interesting things that can kind of get put aside when we go with these larger trends. For instance, there have been stories about energy, you know, engineers or people trying to upgrade their houses, and they'll ignore a lot of the strategies that have been so effective at saving them energy over the years in favor of the hip ones, you know, in favor of getting solar panels. So let's say you have a really nice house with all of these, you know, huge trees that have been there for, you know, 100, 150 years. And those trees are actually great conditioners, right? In the winter, there aren't leaves in the trees, so it lets in the sunlight, so it can warm your house. In the summer, you have the leaves, and that cools your house. So it's an incredibly effective way to get down, actually, your heating costs and air conditioning costs, right? So you can actually save a lot of electricity. But because people could become so obsessed with the idea of solar panels, they might then chop down those trees just so that they can have solar panels on their house and get that electricity. So we can do some very almost counterproductive things, right, in going with these trends, which may be good, but they might not be good in every circumstance.
For sure. So there are two things that I would like to point out. From my own experience, permaculture here is expensive. It requires thousands of dollars because of the capitalist society that we live in. Not to blame everything to capitalism, but and second of all, the whole idea of sustainable development, for me, it was really interesting looking at nature, culture, and power as three different identities interacting with each other all the time, because come to think of it, and anthropology is a great place to start for that, because it makes you really question the sustainable development paradigm and how it's probably, even now, the way it's being talked about, it's such a buzzword. It's based on an economic and not ecological rationality. And it's a discourse that is about using the environment, using the resources in a sustainable way. So the rational management of resources, which is so integral to the Western economy, and its imposition on developing countries is really problematic right now, because it is a regime of truth that is dominating the other world.
And so many of these ideas, right, are, and these efforts, these, you know, development, sustainable development efforts, are guided by previous logic, past logic, right, almost colonial logic.
For sure.
Right, when you think about ideas of the white man's burden and the fact that, you know, it's the developed world that must lead everyone else in this pursuit.
For sure. And Banerjee writes really well, and it's quite funny for me when I read her stuff, because she writes how the white man's burden in the early phases of colonization was the need to civilize the non-white people of the world. And basically that they did that by depriving them of their resources and their rights. In the latter phase of colonization, the white man's burden was their need to develop the third world. And again, this also involved depriving local communities of their resources and rights. And now we're on this third phase, as she calls it, in which the white man's burden is to protect the environment. And this too involves taking control of their rights and resources. But then the salvation of the environment cannot be achieved through the old colonial order based on the white man's burden. And I think when we talk about the human nature dichotomy, we need to move beyond that, because I think the problem, as I see it, is between state control and decentralization of resources. Because if we're going to think about nature in terms of simply something that that is out there, you know, that is untouched, then it leaves no place for human civilization. And we need to understand, philosophically speaking as well, that we are one, and it's a continuum, and it's a two-way interaction. Nature shapes us, and we shape nature.
And it's an incredibly dangerous thing, right, if people, continue having these separations, right? So, you know, people might go to Africa, or they might go to Asia or South America and be doing environmental development efforts. They might be trying to create sustainability and, you know, encourage people to use resources in a more productive way. And then they might come back home and they, you know, put pesticides on their lawn and they do all of these kind of deleterious things for the local environment around them, right? Because there's this division. So it's incredibly important, right, to try to break this down and try to have this holistic understanding wherever the people are in looking at what's around them. So it's very important. But I think also with this, right, we have...
This is a coordinated one-way test of the broadcast stations of your area. Equipment that can quickly warn you during emergencies is being tested. If this had been an actual emergency, official messages would have followed the alert tone. Stay This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
All right. So I guess we just had an emergency alert test. Always good to, you know, keep us up to date and aware of possible emergencies. So in some ways, I guess, so going back to what I was just talking about, I think it's very important for us to, you know, acknowledge these boundaries and then also try to break them down, right, and really understand where these power dynamics are coming from. And of course, we see so much of this also projected into campaigns against global warming and climate change, right, where people, are talking about sustainable development and all of these things as a solution. But there are always, you know, so many dynamics at play. And of course, with climate change, the people who will be affected the most are the people in, with fewer resources.
Yeah, for sure. And you brought up this, you touched upon the Western model and how people are trained in this way of thinking. And I think there's this one particular really striking scene in Amitav Ghosh's novel, The Hungry Tide, where Pia, there's this Indian-American lady who was trained in America, and she goes to the Sundarbans, and she is incredibly passionate about marine conservation. And there's this striking scene where Fakir and Pia stand on the two opposite poles where, you know, the tigers attack this village, and Pia is shocked and she can't believe that these villagers are trying to kill this tiger which is an endangered species. So for her, she couldn't fathom how, you know, why people were doing that, but then tiger attacks are a reality in these villages. Mm. And there's no other way. There's nothing that they can do when the conservation practices stop you from killing an endangered species, but they're killing human lives.
No, definitely. It's a very different perspective, right? And it's important that we acknowledge these perspectives and these experiences. Because one of the problems, right, when we say that, you know, the local people are just harming the environment is we're not acknowledging their perspective, right, and also what they have to deal with.
Yeah, but there's a very interesting twist to that when it comes to indigenous people and local people and how they've almost used their identity as these primitive, savage groups to advance their causes.
Oh, definitely.
So, Slater, in her article, it's infused with this idea that there's this threatened paradise, you know? Wilderness is a threatened paradise that demands protection from the greedy outsiders. But then that also, again, like I've mentioned before, it takes the local people out of the picture. But the indigenous people, by playing onto these ideas of being primitive and a part of nature, connected to nature. They've used their identity to go to these international conferences and forums and dress in their quote-unquote costumes and advocate for their rights as the guardians of the forest. You can see this with the Amazonian Indian activism in Brazil.
And you see, with the Yanomami people in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
Then they've propelled themselves to such a level on the world stage through using their identity. It's similar, you know, just in Massachusetts with the Mashpee tribes and different American Indian groups trying to get casino licenses, right? And they have to dress up, they have to be, you know, American Indian enough, or they have to portray their identity to such a level that they look authentic, right? And it has to do with crafting this image, which is it's a powerful othering, right? Because they're crafting themselves almost in the image of the people looking at them, you know, people from the developed world.
Yeah, and while it has been used as an effective tool, it's also dangerous because it can portray a culture or a group of people as being static. So Martha Honey, I love her work on ecotourism, and she writes about communities where, you know, just when the tourists arrive, they put on a show by wearing these costumes that they don't no longer wear, and they do these dances for them, and once the dances are over, they change into their pants and shorts and T-shirts. And so there is this idea that is very harmful if we perpetuate the notion of the people, these ecologically noble savages, being constant and static and somehow untouched, because they're not. In a globalized world that we live in, they are going to be exposed to the different things in the world, even stuff. Even when the tourists go to these conservation areas, the cameras, the radios, the iPods, the iPads, and all of these communities will be affected by it. So I think, again, I can't say this enough, anthropology is incredibly helpful in trying to understand the real lived life experiences and then using that knowledge to create change. And having them be a part of that change and not alienate them.
And this is a great case study, right, to reflect on the possibilities at stake, right? On the one hand, indigenous communities may be able to further their rights to land. They might be able to get legal protection. They might even get monetary compensation through these performances. But then you also have this this kind of homogenizing of their identity, right? And this almost flattening of their identity. This work, you know, Honey's work sounds very similar to the Komarovs when they describe Balinese dances, right, and how the tourist dances have actually replaced the more traditional dances within the temple. And, of course, because of the popularity, right, and also because of the money coming in. And I think we definitely should recognize, right, that money is actually empowerment to a degree, in that it does give people potential, but it also does had the possibility to flatten out communities, especially with the intense power dynamics at play, right, with tourists and also with ecotourism, right, where we see lots of people coming from the developed world wanting to help a community, you know, lots of very good intentions, but then these might end up as kind of flattened out results where, you know, they're going, they might just work to build a path through a forest, or they might do some sort of a project, but then they might not be really engaging with the entire experience. And then, you know, a lot of people are more willing to do that than actually go into their communities right next to them and have a longer engagement, right, and try to really create change that they can be of a part of for a very long time. Instead, you know, it's nice, you can go travel, you can get a resume builder, and then you come back. So with all of these things, I mean, I think it's a very important to also recognize the good in these projects and the possibilities of good. You know, it's just that there's always these multiple effects, right, that play out. And some are positive, some are possibly negative, and some are mixed. It's just this kind of continuum similar to the paradigms that we see in environmentalism in the Western world, as well as the larger global community now, and seeing what ideas are being projected, what ideas are considered global in the world, right? Of course, with climate change, science is so important, right? And it has so much political power in how people are using different statistical data and whatnot.
Yeah, and the one thing that all of these contradictory efforts and discourses point out and bring to our attention is the power of ideas, the power of thoughts. And even when you talk about climate change, when it comes to mitigation and adaptation, when you look at the European perspectives and when you look at Germany and when you look at these countries who are in the forefront in addressing renewable energy sources, the way they think about this issue is very different from the way Americans here think about climate change and global warming. And it also has a historical legacy. You see how even through romanticism, you have this idea of nature as being something that you have to preserve, which can be bad, which can be not, and it's the contradiction in life that anthropology really makes you understand and accept. And then you see here where it's a debate, and it's an either-or thing, economic development versus environmental protection. And if we don't do away with these dichotomies, then I'm not sure what's going to happen.
It's interesting also, right, reflecting on the difference between American environmentalism and conservation versus European. And I think a lot of this difference is also economic, right, in the economic histories. The fact that in the 50s, you know, gasoline was already incredibly expensive in Europe comparatively to the United States. So you have this economic impetus to be, have some more conservation efforts, to have smaller washing machines, to have smaller houses versus in the U.S. where you have, you know, larger cars, larger houses, this idea that we can have this excess, and it's much cheaper, right? Because we had such access to fossil fuels. You had the oil and gas in Texas, and then also the relationships with the Middle East, with the United States. The government here is incredibly entrenched, almost, it seems, in really trying to get oil and fossil fuels.
But the whole demand is also fueled by your idea of a good life, which is again having a big house, you know, the suburban dream, having a couple cars, and how you define a good life will have an impact on the environment and the resources that you're going to use. And it's scary because even in Delhi, you were in Delhi with me last summer, and it was crazy for me to see these high-rise apartments with swimming pools and all of these amenities and how resource intensive these are. And I think the heart of the issue of environmental protection and climate change, it boils down to almost it's questioning yourself and reflecting upon what are the things that you truly value in life. And again, that requires a lot of learning as well. History is so important to me because it is the historical legacies that shape your culture, the society that you live in. And it's important to question them, and it's important to redefine them.
Oh, yeah. And seeing these ideas of, you know, a prosperous life being projected in India, it shows the power of powerful ideas, right, of the American dream and Hollywood, and how these things have been projected into the global sphere through media, through communication. These ideas of the good life are incredibly powerful, both environmentally and economically. You know, of course, the idea of the American dream of owning your house really played into the subprime mortgage catastrophe. where so many people were so eager to get these houses, right? They were willing to go on so much credit. And these have huge impacts in comparison to in Europe, where you have many more people renting. Just the idea of owning doesn't have that same commitment that it does in the United States.
Yeah.
So cultures are incredibly, powerful in shaping how people live and then how we use resources.
And especially media, there's this one thing that comes to my mind. I think I was talking to one of my professors about this, and you notice how even in children's cartoons these days, when you're watching the television, you have these advertisements about this dollhouse or this new little car, that is shown to be desirable. And then you have kids consistently asking their parents, nagging their parents to get them the doll, the latest Barbie or the Lego blocks, you know? And so you see how it's so inculcated to this idea to want things, material objects. It's so inculcated since you're at an early age. And media is terrible. Media is good at doing that.
I mean, there's lots of possibilities in media too, right? It could have positive impacts depending on the messages. But also, I mean, especially we see, I think your point is spot on, right? We're seeing desires being manufactured physically, right, through these plastic toys. Also another petrochemical substance. And you see, kids driving around in these plastic cars, it gets projected into the future, right? What we do when we're young shapes what we will be
sure.
when we're older.
And when you look at college, since I am an undergraduate student and I live in on-campus suite, you see how we need stuff that we want stuff we don't need. Mm. So you come to... even before I came here, I saw posters and advertisements on Amazon, like back to school sale, like free shipping. And you need the refrigerator, you need a microwave oven. And James Farrell writes pretty well about the nature of college itself and how it makes you so disconnected from the environment and the environmental processes. And I think this disconnection is to be blamed for a lot of our actions, because even wasting water, we are essentially taking a shower from a shower head. We do not know where that water comes from. Mm. We do not know where it goes. It's out of sight, out of your mind, And that's very, very dangerous, because even when you're pooping, you flush it and boom, it's gone. So you don't have to deal with the consequences. And I think it's really important to have an inquisitive mind and actually learn about these things, Don't stop questioning ever, because that will really help you understand the environment that you live in.
Oh, yeah. And looking at college consumption is a fascinating issue. Right, the idea, and we've done a couple episodes on consumption on the show earlier, and just the idea, right, that kids, college kids, need so much stuff, and it's almost taken for granted in our society. I think everyone needs the mini refrigerator, you need a microwave, you need all of this stuff for your tiny dorm room, even if there's a kitchen right down that's communal that everyone could use. Everyone still needs their own separate things, and then of course. The family of these students want to provide these things because they've seen everyone else have it. Why shouldn't my kid have it? Or
but
why
also
shouldn't my niece have it?
It's interesting why even, say, lawnmowers, it's a tool that can easily be shared in a neighborhood. But why are we so hell-bent on owning it? There's something about this individualized society that we live in, especially here, that I've noticed that you are defined by your choices, by who you are and not your community, which is a very stark difference from Asian societies.
And I think this is it's a very dangerous thing. I think at least it seems to me that in Western society, we seem so bound to our things, right?
Yeah.
And we so many of us, I feel, would rather deal with our objects than actual people. And part of that seems to be because objects are just so cheap, right? In manufacturing, we have access to more material goods than ever before, it seems, really. But then it seems to have made us so much more reticent, so much less willing to actually engage with people around us. And especially if we have to deal with, you know, a world with much more unpredictable weather patterns, with just, you know, less goods in general that we'll be able to have for ourselves. Our inability to actually share with one another and to communicate with each other, I think, will become an increasingly huge disadvantage.
And also just understanding that the lifestyle that we have right now is not sustainable. It is not possible. So when we think about, say, a good life, right, and the way the media perpetuates these images to other parts of the world, to Africa and Asia and Latin America, so you see these people wanting that good life as well. Mm. But then it's not possible. We cannot sustain life on this planet if every single person lived like an American human.
It's a huge paradox, right? It seems the more people want so much, and the more, you know, we're all trying to kind of preserve the good life for our own families and our own offspring, the less there is for everyone. You know, we can all be really trying to preserve, you know, we all might be trying very hard to save up money for the future and whatever will come. But then as all of us do that, it could actually make the problem worse, right? Because then we have people vying for increasingly large salaries, and you have people, you know, who are incredibly lucky, just continuing to kind of further this trend towards just trying to get more and more and more without reflecting how all of us could possibly do better with less and less.
For sure. And, yeah, I mean, I don't want it to be all doom and gloom, so maybe we should also talk about how we can possibly have people talk about it and not just environmentalists, quote-unquote, because as research has shown, people do not listen to environmentalists and feminists because they see them as being the other. Again, the idea of othering is very powerful. So I think we need to do away with these labels, and we need to see ourselves as just people living on this planet. And by definition, we should be environmentalists. We should care about these things because it's not just the other person, the environmentalist, who's plagued by these problems. You, if you open your eyes, you will see them around you. And so I think it's important for environmental advocates to branch out, to really try to engage people from other disciplines, because it's not a fight. It's not who's going to win. It's not whose way of thinking is better than the other. I mean, as Ruben says, there better not just be one way of, you know, one theory that explains everything. There better not just be one theory, because we live in a very complex and complicated world. So we need to give people that space and the resources to voice their ideas, to voice their thoughts, and space for them to act upon them and understand them, collaborate, work together. The ideas of community is so important if we are to live together on this planet, because we are, by definition, social beings.
No, without a doubt. And of course, whatever ideas we develop will then be further propelled within to our society, right? Similarly to how Karl Polanyi reflected on how land and labor became commoditized at roughly the same time, right?
Yep.
And we started selling our labor similarly as we sold our land. So it's incredibly powerful, right? And our ideas of the environment are also our ideas of the people around us. These concepts go a very long way. And as we've seen earlier on the show, or just today, really, in this conversation, these paradigms come from our culture and then influence our culture, right? So this kind of constant play back.
Yeah, it's a constant conversation. It's a two-way process. It's never a one-way process.
No, definitely.
Technical difficulties.
Yeah, I think there's some call coming in. But yeah, I think, you know, these are all incredibly powerful ideas to think about. And once again, we see how anthropology can really open up perspectives and give us a lot to focus on with particular subjects, and really blowing up and looking at the multifaceted nature of these different issues within our society, and looking at how we can really use these possibilities available to us. You know, acknowledge the boundaries, but also acknowledge the possibilities.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to look forward to. Well, thank you so much, Alina, for joining us here on This Anthropological Life.
The pleasure is all mine.
Yeah, I think, you know, we really went through a lot looking at cultural paradigms and how they're reflected in the environment, how the idea of the environment itself arises, and, you know, what possibilities there are to deal with future concerns or,
One of the future concerns that I see is... The patenting, the patent rights that corporations are fighting for on neem and basmati rice and turmeric, because these are things that I grew up using. And just to even think that, wow, you know, you guys are trying to make it yours.
Mm.
It's, you can't own turmeric and how it's used.
No, without a doubt, it's a huge thing, right? And we see, and that's the kind of a social change, right? These patents are being projected into other cultures, into substances, right? And as we talked last time on the show, the people who get to name, who get to organize society and the world, that demonstrates the power dynamics, right? So these legal battles, these kind of social questionings are incredibly powerful in determining how we shape our world and what comes forward.
I think to end on a positive note, I think people have started rethinking human agency, and even with movements such as Divestment Campaign, you see how people are attacking the production cycle right at the point of production where it starts. And they are claiming their right to the planet, to their local communities, to their local parks, and it's incredibly heartwarming for me to see that happen. But again, like I said, rethinking human agency also is about working together and empowering each other and talking to each other. Like, it's a communal process.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, it's going to be incredible to see what really develops in our society as we reflect more powerfully upon environmental issues and also larger social questions that go along with it.
Sure.
But yeah, thank you so much, Alina. And thanks, guys, for tuning in. And join us next week as we delve further into environmental anthropology.
And go out for a walk. It's lovely outside today.
Yeah, especially as the weather keeps getting better. Have a good week, guys. Catch you next time. Signing off, this is Anil Tripathi.
And this is Alina.
Have a good week, guys.